Coming to you from Jonesboro, Tennessee, at the International Storytelling Center, we'd like to welcome you to Storytown Radio, Jonesboro's original storytelling radio show.
Thank you, everyone. I'm Lori Olmsted.
And I'm Tom Sizemore. We're glad you could make it.
Tonight, we are celebrating our region's strong women. Our show is set to bring to life some well-known stories and some not so well-known but ought-to-be-known stories about the women who shape our community.
We'd like to thank the Tennessee Arts Commission for their generous support of our program. We'd also like to thank those wild women of Jonesboro.
And we certainly appreciate their supporting the important stories of Northeast Tennessee.
We'd like to thank Nancy Hope and Odie Major for sponsoring the program.
And finally, we'd like to thank Main Street Cafe and Catering for sponsoring us this season.
Tonight's show is also brought to you by the makers of parsley. Yes, parsley, that smooth, easy-going flavor that enhances every meal. Sprinkle it on or garnish a dish.
It just tastes better with parsley. And of course, where would we be without our longtime sponsor, Frozen Toast? Yes, do mornings come early for you? Then Frozen Toast is the answer. From the freezer to the toaster, what could be simpler than Frozen Toast? Hit it, kids!
You know, Tom, I love old movies. Ginger Rogers, Barbara Stanwyck, Ingrid Bergman. They were some of my favorite actors because they played real people, not just damsels in distress waiting for someone to save them. Ginger Rogers once said, "The world needs strong women." There are a lot of strong women you do not see who are guiding, helping, mothering strong men.
Jonesboro has had a lot of pioneering women since their earliest days. In fact, the earliest women were pioneers, because this was Daniel Boone's wild frontier.
But the women from this region, they cut through more than the wilderness of trees and climbed over bigger hurdles than these mountains. Our first story is about someone very special to those of us who love the arts in the region. Ginger Rogers would have enjoyed playing her, I'm sure, because she was certainly a strong woman. Here's Joel.
Mary B. Martin was a lifetime resident of Johnson City, Tennessee. After graduating Boone's Creek High School, she began a 40-year career as one of the first female lab technicians in the Tennessee Eastman Company. Working full-time while attending college during the evenings and weekends, Mary earned her B.S. degree in chemistry from East Tennessee State University. She then became a chemist at Eastman, performing exploratory work in the new polymer systems. A testament to her scientific and creative mind, she received 2 U.S. patents in this field of science. Science was one of Martin's passions. The arts, in all its forms, was another great passion. Her beloved husband of 42 years, Jim Martin, also an Eastman employee, spoke of their lives as scientific people, as well as appreciators of the arts, and explained a connection between the science and the arts. When we expect the U.S. scientists to create miracles of invention and lead the world in these activities, they may be ill-equipped to do this. The arts create a diversity of thinkers, both left and right brainers. Jim Martin understood this about his wife, Mary. It's why he began so many programs and theaters in her name here in Johnson City, including the ETSU Mary B. Martin School of the Arts, the Mary B. Martin Auditorium of Seeger Chapel at Milligan College, the family concert series of the Symphony of the Mountains, the annual Mary B. Martin Memorial Concert of the Johnson City Symphony, the Mary B. Martin Program for the Arts at the McKinney Center in Jonesboro, and the Johnson City Area Arts Council in support of the 28th Annual Arts and Education Conference. Because of her strength and resolve, her breakthrough as a woman working in non-traditional roles, we live in a better, stronger, more vibrant community.
She certainly did, and so did her husband Jim, who sadly passed away in December. They left a legacy that benefits all of us. And in case you didn't notice the big letters outside this building, you walked through the Mary B. Martin Storytelling Hall when you came to the show tonight.
Lori, one of the things I think is important about the women around these parts is their independence. I'd say a fierce independence. We know how to do things. We make sure to get the best education we can. In 1833, newspaper articles written by travelers to the region noted, and they were also astonished by the fact, that Jonesboro boasted both a male and female academy. That was in 1833. Think about it. That is not what most people would imagine when thinking about this region. They may still have wanted to call us hillbillies, but our hillbillies were often more educated than folks in Charleston and Richmond, at least when it comes to the women. It's not surprising that Mary Mee Martin had a scientific mind. It's not surprising that Marion McKinney would become the first woman to serve on the Board of Elections. It's not surprising that many suffragettes in Washington County helped make the right for women to vote a reality by petitioning, demonstrating, making speeches, and proudly standing up for women's rights, which finally convinced Tennessee to become the 36th state to ratify the 19th Amendment on August the 18th, 1920, giving us women the right to vote.
That wasn't even 100 years ago.
That's right, Sadie. And I think it's important to mention that Mississippi rejected it in 1920 and took no action to officially ratify until 1984. I'm proud to be a part of our heritage and legacy by being an independent woman myself. Tennessee was the vote that was needed to make it happen, and in doing so, changed history for all of the United States.
Some of our stories are about the women whose names made the papers and the history books. There are also some, like those Ginger Rogers mentioned, that were independent and strong in much quieter ways. Our good friend Jill came by and shared with us a personal story about what it means to win with grace on a day she couldn't lose.
It was a simple game, a meaningless game, but for some reason, on that particular day, it was my game. I couldn't lose. The game was called Jarts, and it consisted of giant, heavy, handheld darts that you tossed through the air at a plastic circle on the ground. The thick, weighted metal point at the end of each jart caused it to stick firmly wherever it landed. The winner of the game was the player with the most jarts in the ring. I don't know if I was simply having a lucky streak, or if my arm and my brain synchronized in such a way that my body knew exactly how hard and how high to toss each jart with perfect consistency. Or if God was simply amusing himself by watching this small game play out, knowing how the bigger game would end in the long run. I was at a picnic at the home of a friend. It was a singles picnic with food and games and unlimited opportunities to shine or humiliate oneself in the presence of prospective suitors. Before dinner, the hostess produced an official lawn jart set and set it up in her backyard.
Okay, we're ready to go. Who wants to give it a try?
Well, I'd always wanted to try jarts, because lobbing potentially deadly but brightly colored objects through the air looked like great fun. Plus, it didn't involve a lot of sweaty running around, unless you were dodging the jarts.
Oh, I'll give it a try.
Oh, me too.
Are you sure this is safe?
How about you, Jill?
Well, in an attempt to restrain my enthusiasm, I said, well, I don't know. I've never played before.
Oh, come on. It's easy.
Well, at that invitation, I jumped up and my winning streak began. I quickly and gleefully beat the hostess 3 games in a row.
Well, I better go check on the food.
Well, giddy with victory, my normally reserved self scanned the yard for possible players. Well, at that point, I wasn't caring about wins. I was just having a good time. Several others came and played. We laughed and had fun like we were supposed to, and I continued to win. I couldn't lose. I was just about to call it quits and head over to the food table when the only single that I was interested in at the party approached the jarts arena to play.
How about a match?
time, I knew the man was probably competitive, but I didn't know how much that would entail. We played our first game. I quickly won.
I'm just warming up.
We played again. I won.
Let's switch sides.
I won.
Let's switch jarts.
I won. Now, since this was someone I was interested in, I was thinking perhaps it wasn't very attractive on my part to be winning so much. I tried to play the next game with less focus and a little more flirt. I won. I briefly thought about throwing the game, but I grew up with brothers, and that fleeting thought left my head as an unexplained burst of laughter. I tried to make a joke out of the whole thing, but this only seemed to spur on my competition's desire, or was it a need to win?
Another round?
After 10 more rounds, the only thing I was losing was interest in the game. Mr. Handsome refused any suggestions that we stop playing. His determination to win was increasing with each game. Oh, I was in a quandary. Well, I still wanted this guy to be interested in me. I also wanted dinner, but I couldn't lose. I and the jarts had apparently become one. I was having a backyard zen experience of some sort. I was stuck in the flow, and I couldn't get out. Oh, my challenger was growing more frustrated. I saw my chances of a date flying further and further away with each jart that sailed through the air and hit the target.
Now, Jill, you two haven't had a thing to eat. Come have some dinner.
Sure, we can finish up the game after dinner.
No, you won't. You have had enough.
Whew! I watched with gratitude as she scooped up the darts and targets and took them in her house. My unsuccessful opponent headed over towards the food table, and he filled his plate, and he sat with the guys. I grabbed a burger and sat by the girls, many of whom had a crush on this gentleman, and obviously envious of the excessive attention bestowed upon me.
So, what happened?
I won every game.
Good. I mean, good for you.
You could see the palpable relief on their faces by beating him over and over again at the sport. I was no longer considered competition for his romantic attention. It's true. He didn't officially ask me out for 8 months after that. In another 8 months, when the relationship was not the great romance I had hoped it would be, I considered escaping by becoming a professional jarts player and touring the country. However, by this time, jarts was officially banned in the United States. The one sport where I knew I was a winner was no longer an option. And now, I still couldn't lose. I couldn't lose the loser.
Thanks, Nancy Hope. And thanks, Jill, for a great story. Oh, no. I know what that sound is.
It's the time in our show when the cast comes together to share their deep knowledge and wisdom in a piece we like to call
Romy.
Nothing ruins a Friday more than an understanding that today is Monday.
I just missed winning the lottery by 6 numbers.
Dear eyelashes, wishbones, dandelions, 11-11, shooting stars, and birthday candles, can't you just do your jobs?
I wonder how much a zebra would cost if you scanned it.
For daylight savings, we should move the clocks forward an hour on Monday at 9 a.m. so we lose an hour of work instead of sleep.
Studies have shown that women who carry a little extra weight live longer than the men who mention it.
If I had a dollar for every date that found me unattractive, they would eventually find me attractive.
Apparently I snore so loudly, it scares everyone in the car I'm driving.
I just read that 4,153,237 people got married last year. Now, not to cause any trouble, but shouldn't that be an even number?
When an employment application asks who is to be notified in case of an emergency, I always write, a very good doctor.
You know what they say, a clean house is a sign of a broken computer.
You know, sometimes I wonder if Google is my mother, because it won't let me finish my sentence without coming up with other suggestions.
Okay, that is enough, folks.
Lori, there are so many stories and so much history here in Jonesboro. There's one person in town who is here to make sure we storytellers get our facts straight when we're talking about history. And that's our own Ann Jeffellers Mason from the Heritage Alliance of Northeast Tennessee and Southwest Virginia. Let's have her come up and share a story about our strong women from my favorite historical segment, Ask the Historian.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, imagine this. You're invited to a party, and it's gonna be big. I'm talking barbecues and baseball games, concerts and lectures. I mean, this is a multi-day event, and the streets will be packed. Oh, you didn't receive your invitation? Okay, no worries. I've got a spare on me. The event I'm talking about was a 1912 Jonesboro Homecoming, an event that celebrated the placement of the new cornerstone for the third brick Washington County Courthouse. You're probably very familiar with this building. The party was so successful and so well attended that even a newspaper in New York wrote about it. And this was the official image for the 1912 homecoming. Not the first picture that comes to mind when you think party. I use this photo as a teaching tool with students about how times have changed. But all humor aside, and believe me, there have been some very humorous discussions of this image. All humor aside, this is a remarkable picture. Jonesboro chose this picture, these women, to represent the town in 1912. Well, who were these women? From the left to the right, we have Mrs. Eliza Murphy, Mrs. D.T. Wilds, Mrs. Mary Dosser, Mrs. S.J. Kirkpatrick, and Mrs. M.S. Mahoney. These were the matriarchs of Jonesboro, the oldest women in town. They're pictured at the Old Mill Spring, and this picture was printed with the legend about the spring. You know the legend. Anyone who drinks from these waters is destined to return to Jonesboro time and time again. This was a welcome home, a reminder to remember where you came from and who you are. These women were the daughters of brigadier generals, the wives of lawyers and judges, newspaper owners and merchants. It's sad and telling that when I look to our archives now, I find way more about who they were married to than who they were. That's a hole that needs filling. But I think that makes this picture all the more remarkable. Jonesboro could have picked men to be in this photo. I mean, women weren't allowed to vote until 1920, 8 years later, so what good was a courthouse celebration to them? The courthouse is the heart of Jonesboro, and these women were the backbone. And I think that's what this picture is all about.
And you know, it's stories like that that make living here so incredible. We can touch our roots. Or for those of us who are transplants like me, we get to know someone who touched those roots and hear family stories about those tales. Touching history going back more than 100 years, that's powerful.
I have a storytelling tour company here in Jonesboro, and I know this place like I've lived here my whole life, but I'm a transplant too. I was lucky enough to get to know someone who would introduce me to the people, the places, and the customs of this town. Now, 40 years later, I'm a local, I'm from here. But let me tell you how it all happened. The first time I ever met her, she came into my office at the travel agency where I worked, pushed everything aside on top of my desk, and sat up on top of my desk cross-legged. With a crooked smile, she watched me to see what I would do. I had a strange feeling that I had known her a long time ago, but that was impossible because I had just moved here from Denver, Colorado. I carefully removed anything that was breakable on my desk, never taking my eyes off of her. Then I pushed everything else off my desk and onto the floor. Her eyes got real big. Then I jumped up onto the desk, crisscrossed my legs, and said, "I'm new in town. Thanks for showing me how things are done." She smiled at me, and then she said, "Is red really the true color of your hair?" I cracked up, and I asked her if she'd just come out of a major windstorm or did her hair always look that way. She began to laugh and said, "Richter told me to come and check out the new girl to see if you could handle doing tours overseas with a bunch of college students with assorted behavioral oddities. I will tell Richter that we have a real firecracker that just might be fun to work with." She slid off my desk and with a very dramatic gesture threw her scarf around her neck and began to stride away on those long legs of her. I was just getting ready to ask her what her name was when she turned around and said, "Oh, I'm Carolyn Moore, Carolyn Moore of Jonesboro. Oh, and another thing, I have a Christmas party, and you really must come." And then she was gone. I stood there in the middle of my office with everyone staring at me. Renee, who had worked there the longest and always looked like she was getting into mischief, said, "She must have really liked you if she invited you to the Christmas party. Oh, you will love the Moore House. It's small and quaint. Just a little cottage there in Jonesboro." Then they all giggled just like y'all did. And I had a funny feeling I was being set up. I asked around about Carolyn Moore and learned that she not only lived in Jonesboro, the oldest town in Tennessee, but her tireless efforts had helped to put Jonesboro on the map. I received a handwritten note on some Holiday Inn hotel stationery from somewhere out west. The envelope had quite a few mismatched stamps on it, and it looked like it had been retrieved from other letters. The note was a reminder about the Christmas party with the date and the directions to the house, and there was a P.S. "If you have a husband, you may bring him." Well, I was intrigued, to say the least. Unfortunately, my husband, Jim, had to be in Texas and could not attend with me. I went early since I was not familiar with Depot Street. And you could imagine my surprise when I saw all of these cars parked leading up to this massive house with a roof line jutting up to the sky. I made my way up the long driveway and onto the porch, which had rich red velvet curtains hanging. And I thought I was entering a castle. Carolyn had my arm, and she looked down at me and said, "I had no doubt that you would come. Let me take you to Richter." I wasn't sure about that. I never knew anyone named Richter, but off we went. At the far end of the room, there was a man with his back to us, and he looked like he had a black silk smoking jacket on with a dragon on the back. Carolyn introduced us, and he shook my hand, then he held my hand up, looking at my arms, and said, "I think she's a real redhead. She has freckles." They both leaned in and stared at me, and you have to realize I was in my 20s. I didn't know what to do, so I began to blush, and Richter laughed, said, "Oh yeah, she's beet red. She's a real redhead." I was still in shock from this encounter when something that looked like a white bird swooped overhead, and I saw everyone calmly put their hands over their glasses. That, ladies and gentlemen, was my introduction to Carolyn Moore and the beginning of a wonderful 40-year friendship with a very strong woman of Jonesboro. I later learned that Carolyn Moore was one of the movers and the shakers of Jonesboro. She went to Nashville multiple times, working tirelessly to get recognition and funding to put Jonesboro on the map. Oh, did I tell you that Carolyn Moore was the one that suggested I answer the call to be the tour coordinator in Jonesboro over 25 years ago? But that's another story. Oh, there is a multitude of stories that deal with the many, many adventures of the wonderful, strong, and wild women of Jonesboro.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Linda. Carolyn was such a character and truly one of Jonesboro's most vibrant, creative women.
She sure was.
Up next, we've got a story about a very special woman. Why don't you tell us about her, Tom?
It was her smile. Mary's smile was big and bright. It was vibrant. It was a smile of joy. That's the only way I can think to describe it. It just made something inside me pop. We worked together, and I found myself saying the most ridiculous things to her just to see that smile. Then the store closed. We looked for work elsewhere and went our separate ways, until one day a former co-worker told me Mary was working at Kmart. You know what? I suddenly found myself a desperate need to go to Kmart. I don't think anybody has uttered that statement before. But it was true. I walked through the store, looking up and down the aisles, and I found it. That smile. I knew I would vow my life to that smile. In time, we got news that would make me smile just as big. We were expecting. Then came more news. News that would test the smile that had become such a part of our lives together. The first ultrasound showed a fast heart rate, fast enough for the doctor to order tests. The next ultrasound showed the heart was abnormal. If our daughter lived, if, then there would be open heart surgery. If she lived, there would be a good chance our child had Down syndrome. Later that evening, we stood in the living room. How can you sit with news like that? We cried and held each other. Through Mary's tears, I saw her strength and resolve. Whatever our child needed, we were ready. Our child lived. There was heart surgery. There was Down syndrome. And there was laughter and dancing and smiles. Katie had her mother's smile, a daughter, our perfect Katie. They are both the strongest women I will ever know. For years, Mary helped manage the Down syndrome support group Friends. We chose to adopt our next child, and he found us in Russia. And he, too, had his mother's smile. Our family was complete. Then one day it happened. After all the worry, all the care my Mary had for Katie, our son Daniel, me, the support group members, she had somehow missed some signs her own body was trying to give her. It seemed as if it were in an instant, and she was gone. I thought I would never see that smile again. We baked a cake to celebrate her birthday. It was important to the children.
This cake is good, Dad.
Thanks, Daniel.
But, you know, Mom always made the best cakes. Her cakes were the best.
Her smile was the best.
It was. It sure was. I looked at our daughter, Katie, remembering her mother's smile and smiling myself. And there it was, the smile I fell in love with at first sight. Her mother's smile. My daughter's smile. I looked at Daniel, and there it was too, his mother's smile. My son's smile. And I could feel Mary, and I knew she was smiling down on all of us. Happy birthday, Mary. I remember you and your smile. Always.
Thank you, Tom, for telling the story of Mary and Greg and their family. I think that's a three-hangy story.
Well, then let me tell you about my mom. Because then you'll laugh. My mom's a pretty strong woman. I grew up in California, and she and my dad were in a band together and played in Los Angeles. But it wasn't my dad's band. It was more like my mom's band back in the 70s and 80s. And it wasn't a girl's band. It was straight up rock and roll. And it was led by a woman. But so what? That's just what she did. She set rehearsals, and you better have your timing right and be ready for the changes. She called the songs. She could play the piano. She played the piano and sang. If someone in the audience might have had a little bit too much to drink, she knew how to handle them. She had a great sense of humor, so she could be dangerous on a microphone if you tick her off. Most times, she's just as surprised of the things that came out of her mouth as everyone else. I started playing drums with them when I was about 14, probably because they could keep more of an eye on me if I was right there with them. I was known to get into a little mischief, too, but I always say I got it from my mother. I think they got the idea to get me to start playing after this one night they came home late from a gig. Well, see, I was getting to be old enough to stay home with my sister now without a babysitter, but we weren't supposed to have anyone over or anything. Well, I was playing with my friend Chris all day, and then I asked him to spend the night. But I was supposed to ask my mom and dad, but they weren't around because they were at the gig. So Chris spent the night and slept on a sleeping bag on the floor. About 1 in the morning, he woke me up and said that his back hurt, and he wanted to get in my bed, which was very nice. But I didn't want to trade, but he was going to go home. So I said, okay, you can have my bed. So I got on the floor, and he slept in my bed. So I'm on the floor, he's in my bed. After a couple hours later, my folks get back home from their show, their gig, and I hear the door open. My mom comes in to give me a goodnight kiss, pulls back the covers, and flips out and runs out of the room.
Billy! Billy, that is not Brett in there. That is not Brett.
What? What are you talking about?
Billy, that's not Brett. Somebody else. It's somebody else in that bed.
So I hear this, and I wake up Chris, and I make him hide at the foot of the bed. And then I trade with him. I got in his spot, and I pretend to be asleep. Then my dad comes in.
Brett?
Hi, Dad. What's going on?
Nothing. Well, maybe one or two white Russians too many. See, Heather, come here. It's Brett.
But I know that wasn't him. I swear, Billy.
Mom, is that you? Is everything okay?
Don't worry about it. Go back to sleep, Brett. Good night.
I pulled it off. So Chris and I got up really early in the morning the next day and watched cartoons and pretended like he just came over like he always does on Saturday. My mom thought she was losing her mind a little bit, and do you know what? I didn't tell her for like, I only told her about just 2 years ago she finally found out.
Oh, Brett! Brett!
Oh. Shame on you, Brett. I think the fact that she didn't do anything to you after you told her is a testament to her strength.
Well, I've got another story of strength, a story from Carol Redman, and it goes back to what we were talking about with people who touch history here. So let's go back in time on this journey to 1920, just before the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Are you there yet? I'm here. Only now I'm the mother of Carol's favorite aunt, who was arrested on the courthouse steps.
Hey, you're getting a little ahead of the story. If you start it like that, you'll make me sound like a common criminal.
Well, anyone who is arrested in public on the courthouse steps is usually recognized as a common criminal.
Mother, please. This is my story, and I am going to tell it.
Talk about a strong woman.
I intend to. So, it's 1920. I'm a young woman who spent my high school years going to school without the benefit of upperclassmen who were boys because they were off at war. The country was going through huge changes, and I wanted to have a say in what was taking place, but I had no voice. 50% of the people in the United States of America did not have a voice, yet the policies affected all of us. This was wrong. For 40 years, there was an amendment waiting to get ratified. I'm not kidding. Since longer than my mother was alive. That's pretty old.
Watch it!
Here it is, 20 years into the 20th century. I'm 18 years old, ready to vote. Except, Some people who read the law that says all men are created equal did not understand it meant mankind, or humankind, which I am a part of. I had listened to the speeches of some suffragettes, and I heard some speeches given by politicians that I knew I did not want to represent me or my state. So I decided to do something. Since January 6th, 12 states voted to ratify the amendment. We needed 36 votes. Tennessee was still not decided. Around here, there was a War of the Roses. Suffragettes and those who supported them wore yellow roses in their lapels. Those who opposed wore red roses. I was swept up in the momentum. I put on my yellow rose and stood on the courthouse steps to stand for women's rights and speak my mind.
And she was arrested.
Mother!
Come with me, miss.
It's true. I was arrested on the courthouse steps in Nashville, daughter of a prominent Nashville family.
Oh, dear, what will the neighbors say? This is sure to wind up in the society page.
Ma'am, I found your daughter out rabble-rousing with those other women. Looks like they put all kinds of foolish nonsense in her innocent head. We've been friends for a long time, so I thought perhaps just this once I won't book her in jail. Let me catch her again.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
My mother pleaded with me not to protest again, but I was torn. Good thing for me, I didn't have to defy my family in order to stand up for myself. In August, the War of the Roses was over, and the amendment was ratified, and I got to vote for my first president in 1924. So I say this. We stood up, got yelled at, got arrested, got called names, and some had worse. So make sure you exercise your right. For me, and all of us who fought for the vote.
Yes. It hasn't even been 100 years yet. It is important to vote. And not just vote, but vote with information. Educate yourself. The same way women and men in Jonesboro have been educating themselves since the beginning of this town. Read lots of sources and make a decision where you know you'll be standing on the correct side of history. It is our right now, and a lot of people fought and died to make sure all of us, men and women, have the privilege and the duty to vote.
I get to vote in 13 years.
That's right, Sadie.
And in 30 years, you can vote for me when I become president.
Yay! Sadie, I'll be the first in line to fill out my ballot for you.
Thanks, Susan. And thanks, Claire and Phyllis, for taking us back in time. And thank you, Sadie, our future president.
Women who were born in my generation, we weren't taught to be strong when we were little. We weren't told we could become president. Our playtime consisted of playing house and tending to baby dolls, even as our own mothers had just come back from their jobs in the factories, women who were the workforce of this country while the men were fighting overseas. The men were home now. So it was time to put the women back into their place. But the world changed. Women began to see their power both in and outside of the home, and while it was not taught and not encouraged, some of us, born from this time of change, began to teach ourselves how to be strong, how to have agency in this landscape that would never go back to the idyllic picture of Norman Rockwell. Aprons twirling in a kitchen, worn by a smiling woman content to bake cakes and wipe noses while the men of the world took care of the business. Both of my parents were school teachers. My father was teaching in a very fine school district. A high percentage of students went on to college. The town I lived in was different. higher education wasn't part of the picture in my neighborhood school. In the 50s, my parents decided I would go to school in the district where my dad taught. I rode with him to school every day. This was the beginning of my education in how to be alone and how to be okay about that. The other children came from upper middle class families. It was pretty clear what my parents earned from the clothes I wore and the lunch I brought. I also couldn't hang out with the kids because I rode home with my father. I couldn't walk to the movies or go shopping or do any of the things most kids do together after school because that was not my community. When I left each day, it closed like a pond does after you throw a pebble in. I was pretty much alone, but getting a better level of education. During the summers, we'd visit in the Poconos. It was in the middle of nowhere. There were no children. So at 14, I said, I'm going to work. At least I'd be busy being alone. There was a Pops Indian Village. It had a restaurant and a boarding house and a summer cottage. There was a group of girls employed as waitresses and an upstairs girl who cleaned the rooms. I got a job as upstairs girl. I think that toughening and surviving helped me be able to sort things out for myself, not just them, but through all of the challenges I'd meet later in life. I was married to a senior officer, and we lived in Germany. He was one of the very first who was called to go to Vietnam. He was trained as a special forces person. He went to Pleiku, working with the tribes people to build their skills and teach them guerrilla warfare. I didn't know that at the time. I just knew he was going to Vietnam. I had no clue as to how dangerous it was or how close to the border of North Vietnam it was. It was a time that was difficult for me. Actually, it was and it wasn't. I was a wife, but I had no husband around. There was such outrage about the Vietnam War, I was reluctant to tell anyone I was married and my husband was serving in Vietnam. I moved in with my parents. I had them, but no friends to speak of because they were either married or not interested in me because I didn't want to go to bars and such. He came back in 67. People never talked about PTSD or trauma. We got stationed in North Carolina, and our son was born in 1969. And a year later, my husband was sent back to Vietnam. It was different for me this time. We had a child. We didn't live on base, so there was no support from other military wives, and my parents were teaching. They couldn't take care of us. Those years were pretty awful. The riots, the burning of cities. When the men weren't in Vietnam, they were deployed in Los Angeles and Detroit to quell the riots. We suffered with many people whose husbands died in combat. My husband came home with post-traumatic stress disorder. He recognized it early, and he was determined it was not going to have control over his life. He buried himself in academics to deal with the trauma he endured, and, well, he isolated himself, withdrew from the family. How could you say it was not a good idea that he was getting another degree? We divorced in the late 70s. I was alone, but not alone. I had a son. I went into teaching, but it wasn't for me. There was a job fair in Atlanta. I was interviewed by General Motors. I had a science and German background, so they invited me to come to Flint, Michigan for an interview. I went, and I realized after I got there, they had a chemistry job for me. Now, I knew I wasn't a lab person. The man who interviewed me had the periodic chart of elements hanging on his wall. No artwork at all. I thought, oh no, oh no. But he opened my eyes to other possibilities. I found out what production management was all about. It was also a time when companies were hiring women in non-traditional areas, in factories, as supervisors and managers. That was the opportunity I was given. I was a foremanette. Not a foreman, but a foremanette. That was in 1977, and I loved it. I just loved working in the factory and the people, and that began my career until 2000. I worked at GM and then at Lockheed. At GM, we had both a car line and a truck line, and you bounced around from lines depending on where they needed a general supervisor. I got assigned to the trucking department. They called me Mother Trucker. I had more difficulty with my peers than my subordinates. The men who were the other supervisors didn't want me there. It was an endurance test to see if I would fail, if I would capitulate. I was determined never to say a word to my supervisor about these shenanigans. They would send me off on wild goose chases for something that was right there. Terrible, duplicitous, mean-spirited things. They eventually saw I wasn't going anywhere, and I was doing a good job. They learned what a mother trucker really was. I was the first woman they brought in. I was a street hire who didn't rise up through the ranks. There was no social life for me in that community, but I knew how to live apart and how to find friendships in other places. That's when one year I took a class in storytelling. It was an evening class, 2 hours a week class to learn to be a storyteller. And in time, that would be how GM's biggest mother trucker found her way to Jonesboro. That looks like all the time we have tonight.
Starring Summer Buchanan, Susan Burke, Phyllis Fabozzi, Stephen Goodman, Abby Hawthorne, Marcy Holly, Sadie Hyatt, Nancy Hope Major, Ann Mason, Lori Olmsted, Linda Poland, Nancy Ray, Joel Van Eaton, Claire and Joseph Winkler, and Tom Sizemore.
And of course, our sponsors, the Tennessee Arts Commission, those wild women of Jonesboro, Nancy Hope and Odie Major, and Main Street Cafe and Catering.
And we'd like to especially thank you, our listening audience. Be sure to tune in the last Wednesday of the month at 8 p.m. on 89.5 FM WETS to hear our program, or listen online to WETS.org on HD Channel 1.
Good night, everyone.